Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Coach Kelly.
We're going to have a fun show today. Thank you for tuning in. And as usual, we do love to get your phone calls and your emails. So if you have a pen and paper handy, jot down our number and give us a call at 323-203-0815. Again, 323-203-0815. And of course, you can always email us. All right, Kelly, do tell again what happened. Your kids got sick? Both?
Oh, God. So my husband goes away for the weekend, and it's like there's very little chance that my kids would get sick. But of course, I don't know. I beat all statistics, I guess. He had 101, almost vomited. And you know, I've talked about my phobia of vomit many a times on this show, but I think the hypnotist is working for me a little bit, because I seem to have a little bit of a less fear. Like, instead of a 10, it was now it's like maybe an 8.5, which is a big difference.
Okay, that's good.
So it's a little bit of a crazy weekend, but you know what? It wasn't as bad as I had thought. So that's the good news. It was like, you know what? I can get through this.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, before we introduce our exciting guest for today, who may be able to help you a little bit with your vomit phobia, just talking about it gives me the heebie-jeebies. Anyway, we had a great couple of shows. If anybody missed our last few weeks, we did a series on parenting, everywhere from parenting young kids to teenagers to adult kids. And we also did a special show on
divorced
and step-parenting. I feel like I disclosed too much last week. So if you actually want to find out more about my background, my sordid relationships in my life, go listen to that show.
Yeah, exactly. No, I loved hearing it. It was so interesting. And I think it was really relevant and helpful to the listeners.
Okay. Well, with no further ado, let's introduce our guest. Do you want to read the introduction or you want me to do it for you?
Go for it.
Okay, we are going to introduce you today to Alex George, who has a very difficult last name, but he told us we could just say Alex George, and then he will, in a moment, tell us what his actual last name is. And he's got a wonderful Australian accent. He is the number one best-selling author, speaker, and multidisciplinary psychologist focusing on mental health, success, happiness, and entrepreneurship. His latest book, Maximum Mental Health, is a comprehensive life enhancement manual outlining 20 principles for happier and healthier living, including how to improve optimism, sleep, nutrition, motivation, self-esteem, social skills, relationships, achievement, and much more. And we'll give out his website in a little bit, but in case you have a pen and paper, it is MaximumMentalHealth.com. And we are having him on in honor of Mental Health Awareness Month.
Month, exactly.
Yeah.
It is Mental Health Day.
All right. So welcome, Alex.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here, girls.
Come on, speak some more. We got to hear that accent.
I love it. I said he could talk the whole time. I just love
Okay. Maybe you should just give me the alphabet and I'll just recite it.
Are you in Australia now?
I actually am, yes.
Oh, cool.
What time is it?
It is 6 a.m.
Oh, that's not bad.
That's not terrible.
I've been up since 3, but yes.
Oh.
Well, me too, except that's because I couldn't sleep. It had nothing to do with wanting to get up at 3 a.m. So maybe you can help me out with that a little bit. But tell us, do you want to just dive into some of the questions we have for you, or do you want to give us maybe a little bit of your personal story, how you got into writing this book, and kind of your overall interests?
Yeah, sure. So basically, I've always had a fascination for people. I've always loved people. Way back when I was at university, I studied creative writing and psychology because I felt that the two coincided with the idea of understanding character, understanding yourself, and being able to help people. And I had that creative desire and that drive. I never really realized that I'd end up writing nonfiction as opposed to fiction. Sort of towards the end of my training, I kind of discovered positive psychology, which is the study of happiness and thriving and doing all those wonderful things about being your best. And so what happened was I kind of did my clinical training and the positive psychology training, and I kind of melded the two, and I've been doing that ever since. And then when it came to writing this book, it's really kind of interesting. I've always believed that when you are feeling down or low or alone, you need to find a creative pursuit, a creative outlet.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened to me was my partner went away for a month because she's from the other side of the world and she was over in Europe. And I was lonely and annoyed, and I thought, well, what do I do? How do I channel this? So I said, I'm going to write another book. And so I set a goal to actually write the full draft of this book in that month she was away. And I actually achieved that, which was pretty remarkable. And that's kind of how it all started. And then the idea behind the book is the idea that what do people do? I mean, we look at life right now and there's so many problems. I mean, over 50% of people are overweight, over 50% of people suffer from high stress, over 50% of people have relationships that don't last. So I started thinking about all these things and I thought, well, how do I tackle every one of these things? And so I kind of went after everything I could think of, from motivation to optimism to sleep to nutrition to self-esteem. And I went through every single thing and I kind of created those 20 principles based on that idea.
Wonderful. I'm impressed.
Me too.
In terms of being able to write the whole manuscript in a month. You might be the only other person that I know, and actually you beat me. I wrote my first manuscript in 6 weeks, but it was in my head for so long, so it was easy to put it on paper. What inspired you, specific inspiration was the loneliness, or had you had this kind of idea in your mind for a long time?
The idea was there, or part of the idea, but it was the idea of what do you do when life sucks? And I'm not saying obviously, you know, life was horrible, you know, she was just away. It wasn't like she was never coming back.
Sure.
But it's the idea of, you know, I've always dealt with this because we were in a long distance relationship for many years. And I always did that. I always felt during those long periods apart, because sometimes we wouldn't see each other for 5-6 months. How do I channel this? How do I channel this into something creative, into something good? And so that's kind of what I do. When I actually become more productive, more healthy, more vibrant, well, not vibrant, but yeah, just, you know, I channel that when I'm alone. And then in terms of this actual book, what it came down to was, yeah, I mean, I've been doing this stuff for over 10 years and I thought, well, what do people actually need right now? And so I said, well, I know all this different stuff. How do I make it a simple, practical, principles-based idea? So every chapter was about one specific topic based on a specific principle that could be summed up in a sentence and then expanded and given quick action techniques so people could really just focus on that and do that after just, you know, whatever chapter that they're looking at. So it might be, how do I increase my mood? Or it might be, how do I have more pleasure? Or it might be, how do I improve my sleep? And just what are those key techniques for that one particular thing. So the book can be read chronologically, but it can also just be read of the chapter that you need at that time in your life.
That's great.
Wonderful. Yeah, I'm going to give our listeners a little sample here because I like the way you organize the book. It looks, part one is the principles of increasing motivation. Part two, the principles of enhancing mood and living well. Part three, the principles of meaningful life. Part four, the principles of life mastery. And then I like that you gave a bonus,
yes,
the principles of magnetism. Those are all wonderful. Yeah, I think we all could use some bonus,
exactly,
and some help in those. So let's get a little specific here. What is the fastest way to get out of a depressed state and get motivated?
That is a fantastic question. In my opinion, it's move. Move, 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 move. The more you move, the better you feel. The better you feel, the more you move. If you think of a depressed person, you're going to notice that their head is down, their eyes are down, their shoulders are slumped, their breathing is shallow. And a motivated person has the exact opposite physiology. And so movement is this great antidote to depression because it increases motivation. If there's one secret to motivation, I call it the act now principle, which is basically the biggest trick, which is understanding that motivation comes during and after the behavior, not necessarily before the behavior. You do not need to feel motivated before you start to become motivated. You just start, you make the goal, you make it super easy. So for example, you want to exercise for an hour, commit to just 10 minutes, but just start it. And as your motivation and momentum builds, you'll find it easy to increase the goal as you progress.
It's fascinating. We have two phrases out here. One of them is fake it till you make it.
Yes.
Which is a big one in America when people are having trouble just, you know, not having
doing
the feelings
it
behind the action yet. So it's like, okay, just act as if,
yes,
you're good with it and then that will come.
Right.
Yeah, that's really good. And then the other one for depression we talk about is counteraction. So while depression may make you want to go and hide in bed or eat too much or stay asleep for too long or watch too much TV, whatever that action is to do a counteraction. So I love that. That's pretty much what you're saying as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I always say, it's a very simple principle, but if you think about it in terms of the happy chemicals in our body, in our brain, serotonin, noradrenaline, dopamine, I mean, I use the metaphor of an orange juice bottle. And basically, if you imagine the pulp as the nutrients, and where does the pulp go if it just sits there?
To the bottom.
Right.
Right. So what do we need to do to make the juice taste good?
Shake it up.
Exactly.
Right. So it's that exact same principle where humans are no different. Those pleasure chemicals, if you like, those nutrients, to get into the brain, we need to move, and that sort of circulates all that so much better, passes the blood-brain barrier, get more of that into the places where it needs to be. And so I think that's kind of an easy way to think about just how important it is. And just the more dynamic you are, so that movement principle relates to everything. Like if you breathe deeper, you're moving more. If you stand taller, you're moving more. If you speak a little bit more firmer, you're moving more. And so that's why confidence is related to all those things, because you're actually feeling better.
Wow. I love that analogy.
Yeah,
I'll never look at orange juice the same
way. I also love that you have described something that didn't require an enormous amount of physical energy. While maybe taking a run or a walk or climbing or something is great, but I work with a lot of people with back pain, myself included sometimes, and movement in that form is just not possible sometimes.
Yes.
So I like that you've added in that just changing the way you speak, changing your posture, changing the way you observe things and think about things, that's all under the umbrella of movement.
Yeah,
good job.
I love that. So a lot of people in this country have anxiety attacks. So I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about that and kind of maybe how to stop an anxiety attack.
Yeah, so there's classically three kind of methods, and they all work, and I like to actually combine them, all three of them. So the first thing is to calm yourself through diaphragmatic breathing. In other words, just to breathe more from your stomach and less from your chest. So you stand straight, you breathe deeper in a 3-second cycle. It'll tend to calm you. The second method is distraction. So one option is to just count backwards from like 300 in threes, so 300, 297, 294. So you're doing that as you're breathing. And the third skill is one of my favorites, is mindful acceptance.
Okay.
And this is rather than trying to make anxiety go away, which doesn't work, it causes more panic, because now you start panicking about being panicked and worrying about worry, and you know, you do all that. So if you aim to accept the fact that there is anxiety in your body, and it's going to do whatever it's going to do, and you remain accepting of it, you know, you accept the racing heart, you accept the butterflies in the stomach, you accept the catastrophic thoughts. And as a quick outline here, you cannot die from a panic attack, so that's very important for people to keep in mind. Then that process will pass in its own time. And that's a very important principle. So I like to work with all three. So you change your breath, you can do some distraction if you like, and you just practice that mindful acceptance. And that's really important, because that's what it said, that anxiety is there as a protective mechanism. Sometimes it's overprotective, and being accepting of it rather than trying to get rid of it is what allows that to pass through more easily.
That's so amazing, because I talk about that too as the paradox of change. The only way to change is to accept what is.
Yes.
And the anxiety is not going to go away as long as you're fighting it and pretending it isn't there, just embracing it. I remember the first time I had to do public speaking, which I was terrified of, like my worst fear on the planet. And I was training in Gestalt therapy, and one of their techniques is, okay, well, if you're going to stand up in front of a room and you're going to be anxious, just stand there and say, I'm anxious.
Yes.
Right. And I did. And it was better.
Because you just accepted it and
did.
You can move on.
It was amazing, because I fought it so much. Oh, that would be so embarrassing. People will think I'm stupid. But, you know, when you think that almost all people have some level of performance anxiety or social anxiety or something that they've had to overcome, most people are going to be compassionate about that.
Of course.
But that's great.
And it makes you human, too. I think in the audience, it's like, oh, she's human. Like, okay, she's like us. You know, here's this expert, but she's nervous, you know?
Yeah. Well, unless you're a psychopath, you're going to have anxiety.
Right. For sure. That's true. Good point. Do you do speaking on these types of subjects also, or just when you're doing book interviews? Just curious.
Oh, no, I speak about this stuff all the time. And you speak about speaking as a great example. Yeah, so, you know, I will have the heart rate increase. I will have a little bit of shakiness or whatever. And I'm thinking to myself, good, good, let it be there. Let it be there. It means I'm alive. It means I'm ready. It means I'm ready for this. So it is that acceptance principle I take. Like if I was to stand up and speak and there was no change in heart rate, or if I was too relaxed, I'd be like, something's clearly wrong here.
Yeah. You know you're on track, basically.
Right. And do you know if those studies still show up where performance anxiety, a moderate amount of anxiety, actually leads to better performance? I remember those old studies.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so the whole eustress, distress kind of continuum. Yeah, so basically we need a mild to moderate amount of anxiety to make us alert and prepared and focused. But if we go too far, and that happens when we start worrying about the anxiety, we dip into the fight or flight response and we start losing our skills. So yes, we want to have that sort of mild to moderate anxiety, and that's how we balance that. We balance that by being accepting of it, letting it be there, and still focusing on how you want your outcome to go.
Sure. That makes sense.
Just as a side note, because I have actually a friend of mine who suffered from a condition called adrenal fatigue. How, are you familiar with that, Alex?
No, but I think I can figure out what it means.
It's basically overuse of the adrenal glands, and then they're not able to re-regulate in the body anymore, and it's almost like being in a constant state of over-aroused sympathetic nervous system, and
just
the parasympathetic nervous system unable to calm down, and it's quite a frightening syndrome.
I'm wondering, I mean, if that could be related to extreme sports. So there's a lot of extreme sports people that they get addicted to flow, and basically if your life's on the line, you find flow states really quickly very often because your body is forced to do that. And so you're going to have these massive pumps of adrenaline, obviously, and they become addicted to that. And so when they're not risking their life, they become very depressed. So I wonder if there might be a connection with that.
Yeah, this particular woman, it was actually just being in a workplace environment that was incredibly stressful, where she kind of felt like she was being targeted. And I think she was, and it was just really, really challenging.
It was
just
so intense for her.
It was just so intense. Yeah. So it was probably probably similar mechanisms to what you're describing.
Right.
Oh, I forgot when I gave your introduction, Alex. I promised our listeners that you would pronounce your last name for us.
Yes, sure. So my last name is pronounced Serbanowski.
Serbanowski. Are you Polish?
No, it's a Macedonian background.
Ah, okay.
So cool.
Serbanowski. All right, but we're going to stick with Alex George.
Right.
By all means.
Okay.
So, let's just do a quick review for our listeners. We are talking with Alex George, who wrote the book Maximum Mental Health, and you can visit his website, which is MaximumMentalHealth.com.
Yes, absolutely. I was so mesmerized, I forgot about that. And we are celebrating Mental Health Awareness Month. And if you do have a question for either Dr. Deborah, Coach Kelly, or Alex, please call us at 323-203-0815. Again, 323-203-0815. And Alex is joining us from Australia.
Yes.
He is in Australia. What part of Australia?
I'm in Sydney.
In Sydney. So cool. Oh, the last time I visited there was over 30 years ago. Has it changed a lot?
No, not at all. We're completely backwards.
Oh, good. I remember the Opera House and coming into where that whole area is and just being so mesmerized when I saw it. So beautiful lit at night.
Oh, don't even tell me this. My dream is to go to Australia. I want to go so badly. It's my next like big trip. So I will be there, Alex, knocking on your door.
Sounds good. I will let you in.
We may show up together. We can do a whole show from out there.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a good idea.
Sounds good to me.
Hey, so have you always been a optimistic person, or were you once pessimistic and you turned yourself into an optimist?
Oh, that's a great question. I would say I've always been an optimist, but I've definitely spent a lot of time with pessimists. There are definitely pessimists in my family. And I think the question often becomes, how do you turn a pessimist into an optimist? Is it actually possible?
Yes.
And I think the key is to really look at changing the thinking style of the person. So the simplest way to think about it is to keep practicing on what you do want as opposed to what you don't want. So let me give you a few questions just to think about, just off the top of your head. Would you rather be less stressed or more relaxed?
More relaxed.
Would you rather be less anxious or more confident?
Kelly?
It's so funny. See, all these, I'm going to say less anxious.
Okay. And I'm going to say more confident.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
This is interesting.
Would you rather be, and I'm not saying you two are this, would you rather be less fat or more trim?
More trim.
Yeah, I have to say that too. More true.
Right. So the reason I say this is because if we were robots, those two questions are kind of the same. If you're less stressed, you're more relaxed. If you're more relaxed, you're less stressed.
Yes.
So it's pretty much the same thing. But we're not robots. We're humans, and humans are emotional. And there's an identity component. So let me just pick one of those. If I say less fat, more trim. Is there a problem if someone achieves the goal of being less fat? What do you think?
No problem.
Okay. So the answer is yes and no. So there's no problem in terms of, well, I'm less fat, which is the goal, but I call it a dirty goal because in terms of identity, if you are less fat, you are still seeing yourself
as fat.
Oh, I see.
Yes, it's the label that has such an emotional, it's like
component.
Words can have so much power in and of themselves because we have negative value attached to them. So in this country especially, people say, oh, fat, that's bad,
as
opposed to trim, which positive.
Is good,
Yeah. So I can
the
see that.
And I use trim instead of skinny as well.
Uh-huh.
Because
sure.
Can you be too skinny?
Yes.
Yes.
Can you be too trim?
No.
Maybe.
Yeah. That's really interesting.
Right. I want to be just trim. Just trim enough.
That's fine.
Wait, but in Australia, are Australians as focused on their appearance as Americans as far as physically?
Australia follows America a lot.
Yeah.
So a lot of trends in America, Australia is like the little baby brother, which is good and bad, because when it's a good trend in America, we tend to follow it, and when it's a bad trend in America, we tend to follow it as well.
Right.
There's a lot of great things in America that, you know, Australia likes to emulate, but then there's also some of the things like, you know, I think America has the most overweight people in the world, and I think Australia is now number two. So there aren't things that are great that are happening as well.
Yeah. Hmm. That's interesting.
What about local fashion magazines and such in Australia? Do you have models on those who are more normal, healthy weight, or more of the anorexic, skinny types that we have here?
Yeah. Well, once again, I think we're following the American model very much in that kind of area.
Well, that's upsetting.
Yeah.
Well, that's too bad.
Yeah, it is too bad. I mean, but if the American model is being followed all over the world. I mean, there are a lot of countries now that are having, you know, sort of anorexia and these kind of issues that never existed before.
Right,
like,
yeah, we've talked
weren't
about
even
that.
Part of the culture.
But I do think America is changing a little bit, good or bad, however you feel about the Kardashians. I think it has had a positive effect on women's bodies because, I don't know if you watch the show or you know who I'm talking about, but all the Kardashians are a little bit more voluptuous and curvaceous. And I think in so many ways, this is really great for young girls to realize, okay, curvy is sexy and you don't have to be this, you know, waif-like type to be considered attractive. So I think it's a positive.
I think that's fine. I mean, yeah, it's fine. I mean, obviously, we're aware of the Kardashians. They're everywhere. Yeah, I think that. But then at the same time, there are these stories of her doing surgery to create more voluptuousness or her butt's been done or something. So once again, there's this sort of double-edged sword with that. And it's just trying to find that place in yourself where I am who I am, I do my best, and I'm okay with that, and I'm here to, you know, excel and do what I can based on where I'm at. And so coming back to this idea of these principles, like I said, using those correct words about being more confident or being more relaxed or finding that place of trimness, you know, and being healthier, being more vibrant, you know, thinking about the words you use because there's power in those labels. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're trying to do here.
And so you feel like to help a pessimist, you need to just kind of reframe those wording and that would help that person.
Absolutely. I like to use this example. If you're in a racing car and you're driving against the wall, and I sometimes trick people and I say, what do you think? There's a big wall then, and they think, don't hit the wall. And I think, if you think don't hit the wall, what does the brain hear? Wall.
Right.
So there's a good chance you're going to end up
hit,
in
hit.
The wall.
Yeah. And hit.
Yeah.
So as opposed to saying, keep my line or stay straight or focus on the road, and that's going to pull you in a different direction. I mean, that's what optimism is. Optimism is focusing on what you actually really want.
Mm-hmm.
And what pessimism is focusing on what you don't want. So one is pain-based, trying to avoid pain. The other is pleasure-seeking.
Oh.
And so the idea is to keep those words, those positive words, towards that pleasure end of the continuum.
That makes sense. So I want to talk a little bit about kind of modern life, office life that most Americans live. So I know in your book, you talk a little bit about how modern offices, buildings and homes and just making our mental health a lot worse. And we're just, Dr. Deborah and I were wondering, how is this possible?
Yeah. So basically, many modern buildings, including the one I'm often in, have no windows, no natural air, no natural light. There's a lack of vegetation, there's a lack of life. And so our environments are becoming more artificial. But nature's what makes us feel good, you know, and we can't trick our brain. They've done a lot of studies on this. A picture of nature cannot compete with a window,
right?
There's no replacement for sunlight and fresh air. So if you're working in these kind of environments, like I am, I work in an office that has no windows, you know, doctor surgeries, things like that, you've got to get out of that office as often as possible. You've got to get that fresh air. You've got to spend some time with trees and sunlight and nature and all those things, because we can't trick our brain, you know, and that's such a thing. Like a lot of modern office buildings, they don't even have natural air anymore.
Oh,
and
well.
It's really, it just doesn't work as well. Like, we can survive in these environments, but we don't thrive as much. So you want to get out as often as possible, because our modern buildings really aren't very good for our mental or physical health.
Sure. Makes sense.
It's fascinating because I spent most of my life living in the Los Angeles area. And about 10 years ago, I moved out to a much more rural area that's, mm-hmm. you know, still part of LA, but it's in Ventura County. And I notice a huge limited tolerance now when I get into the city, whereas I used to have like tolerance, I don't think it was healthy for me, but of traffic, of this, of that. And now when I have to drive in those sorts of situations, or if I'm enclosed for too long, because I live in such an open area, all the the hiking trails and everything are in my backyard, it's amazing. So my tolerance has completely, I've lost my tolerance for it. And I can totally relate to what you're saying, Alex, that just even spending 2 hours in an enclosed room, whereas I used to just find that to be normal. Now I can't do it. Yeah. I have to get up and move and be outside and do something else.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, I know in the intro that you do help with sleep. Well, I have been having terrible sleep lately, and I've been doing all of the essential oils and all the right things that the sleep experts say. Do you have any other magic for me?
I don't know exactly what you're doing. I'll kind of address this more to the listeners. I think the key is always reducing stimulation. And there's two parts: reduce stimulation and clear the mind of worry. So in terms of stimulation, you know, you shouldn't be watching TV within an hour of bed. The light levels should be low and reduced. The room should be dark and quiet. To reduce worry, I like to get people to write out a to-do list before bed, but with each item, you ask yourself, what is the maximum amount of time I have to complete this task? And what is the worst thing that could happen if it's not done? Now, these are two really important questions, because worry is often this kind of rushed feeling. It leads to a rushed, anxious feeling. And what most people don't realize is we have a lot more time than we think.
Right.
Like, and we need to teach ourselves that we actually have that time, that whatever you need to do, it's not an emergency. You can be more relaxed about it. So asking yourself, what is the maximum amount of time I have to do this, and what is the worst thing that could happen if I don't do it? Because 99 times out of 100, the worst thing that could happen is actually really small. It's like nothing.
Sure.
And then the third thing, which I really suggest, is practicing mindfulness, which just clears the mind, settles the body, and gratitude, which is the idea of you think of a few things each day that happened that was positive, and you just kind of write them down, and that kind of leads to better dreams as well. A lot of people that have bad dreams, the reason they're having bad dreams is because of what are they being stimulated by as they're going to sleep or just before bed. If you're watching crime shows and then you're worrying about tomorrow before bed, you're probably going to have worse dreams than if you're in a calm place, you're relaxed, you're being mindful, you're being grateful, then you have a very different response.
That makes sense.
Okay, wonderful. I could definitely rev up a little bit more of the mindful, grateful,
sure,
and less of the crime.
Exactly. Yeah,
television.
Exactly. Sure. So.
Yeah, and in the book, I actually give away mindfulness recordings, so people can actually, they get the book. They actually give three mindfulness trainings away with the book.
Oh, that's cool.
And they also have, I think, within 24 hours of this show, I've got some free videos that they get as well if they get the book within today.
Wonderful. And if you did just tune in, you are listening to Dr. Deborah and Coach Kelly and our special guest, Alex George from Australia, who's written the book Maximum Mental Health, when he gives us all kinds of fun principles to a better life in terms of our self-esteem, motivation, nutrition, optimism, and relationships. So if you have a question for either myself, Coach, or Alex, please call us at 323-203-0815. Again, 323-203-0815. And Alex just mentioned that he's going to give away some freebies if you order the book within the next 24 hours. That's really nice, too, that you do include these mindful recordings.
Sure.
That's so, I understand for so many people that auditory, just being able to close one's eyes and listen to somebody else's voice to help them relax is so helpful.
So soothing. Now, do you...
Yeah, there are certain things that you just... I put it in the book how to do it, but yeah, to have the actual recordings makes it a lot easier.
Can you listen while you're driving, or do you need to be totally, you know, stationary and not...
You can. I would, first few times, I would do it because I suggest you close your eyes. You can do it with your eyes open, and you definitely can do it whilst driving. Mindfulness, the whole principle of mindfulness is that with practice, it becomes more and more part of your everyday being and everyday life. So, yes, the first few times you listen to the exercises, you probably want to do it eyes closed, quiet place, just so you get the hang of it. But then you can do it with eyes open, absolutely.
Okay, great. So I had a question from a listener in the past who had complained that he is completely stressed out but really can't. Doesn't have time for the physical exercise, which he really needs, and is just constantly in that stress state. Is there something that you could suggest for somebody who just is working all the time and kind of can't get that physical activity, or is there other things that they can do to feel a little bit better?
Sure. I think the answer to that question is you're making the goal too big. So in terms of physical activity or even mindfulness or some other things I could think of, just do 2 minutes. There's no rule that says you have to set aside half an hour or an hour to do these things. And that's where most people shoot themselves in the foot. They say, I don't have time, which is absolutely rubbish. The point is you don't know how to utilize your time properly. I'm sorry. If the Prime Minister of Australia or the President of America, I know the Prime Minister of Australia used to exercise every morning, go for a walk. Okay, so come on. So you're telling me you don't have the time? Rubbish. You do have the time.
Right.
You just don't know how to use it. And so, but I don't want to make someone feel bad and say that. What I would say is, how do we make it just 2-3 minutes? You can do 2-3 minutes of vigorous exercise, running on the spot, star jumps, as many push-ups as you can, as many sit-ups as you can, and you get this massive motivational and physical boost. Or alternatively, you can practice mindfulness for just 2-3 minutes. And that's kind of one of the major hacks that I talk about with mindfulness, one of the major secrets. You don't set aside 20 minutes, 30 minutes in the beginning. You just do for 2-3 minutes, and you just build that skill. And that tends to be, you know, you do that 2-3 times a day, and you're going to get a better effect, and you're going to get more motivation than if you try and set aside half an hour, which you're going to find hard to do.
That's great. I think that's great advice. Really spot on.
I was just laughing as you were saying that because this little running joke I have with Christopher's my guy. And when he says at the end of the day, when he has had a couple of to-do list things, that items on it that were actually for my benefit, he goes, oh, I didn't have time. And I always say, no, you had the time. You just put it somewhere else.
Yes, exactly.
And then we laugh. So now he says, honey, I chose not to do that today. I say, okay, well, that's empowering. At least
exactly.
Now you're taking ownership.
It.
Yep, I chose not to do that. It's cute. Oh, great. This is good stuff. I want to know a little bit more about how would you help somebody who has a terrible fear of rejection? I have this young woman I'm working with right now, and you know, I give her my tricks and tools and all that stuff, but she has to go out and get a job, and she's been in recovery now for about 8 months from drugs and alcohol, and she's just so paralyzed and immobilized by her fear of rejection. So do you have any tips for me for her?
Yeah, I guess once again it comes back to what I said before, is make the goal really small, really easy. So if she has this terrible fear of rejection, I'd start with things like, can you just walk past people on the street? And then after that, can you say hello to people on the street? Or if you want to ask them a question, give them an easy one, like, can you ask people for the time? And so you just start building these sort of skills gradually, and each time that happens, it's a little exposure. So it's a little sort of shaping mechanism to sort of build their skill up. So I don't really know at what level they're. I'm assuming they're like extremely afraid of people and rejection. So you kind of see where they're at, and then you just kind of build those little skills piece by piece by piece by piece. In terms of a cognitive, in terms of a thinking process related to that, it goes back to that principle I spoke before about focus on what you do want as opposed to what you don't want, and at the same time, be accepting of the anxiety. The anxiety will be there, but it's about learning to be accepting of it rather than trying to get rid of it. So for her, it's not the idea of I should be completely confident and feel awesome and just be able to say what I need to say. It's, okay, I'm going to have this little goal, I'm going to be accepting of the anxiety, and I'm going to focus on what exactly I want to say. I want to practice that a few times in my mind and then just do it again and again and again. And I think that is the best way to shape that behavior.
Sure.
Okay.
I think that sounds great. I wanted to read an email that we got that I think would be relevant, and maybe you can give the advice to this, Alex. It says, Dear Dr. Deborah and Coach Kelly, what's your advice for someone who has to work at a job they hate, but they need the money? I'm at a desk job, and I despise my job right now. The money's good because I've been there long, but I just don't have the luxury of quitting right now to pursue my dream of becoming an artist. I know everyone says you should follow your passions, blah, blah, but if I truly did that, I'd be flat broke eating ramen noodles. Is there a middle ground, or is this how the majority of Americans live and I just have to accept it? Signed, want to be the starving artist but can't.
I love it. I love it. That sounds awesome. I have a phrase that I use with people, which is follow your dreams but cover your responsibilities. Nobody respects a deadbeat dreamer. So what I'm referring to there is this is the reality of life. You've got to follow your dreams. You definitely want to do that, but you've got to cover your responsibilities. Okay,
sure.
It's just the reality of things. And so the way I would answer that question with her is there's a couple options. One is what time can she forge aside for her creative passions, for her pursuits? Can she make it just an hour a day and just build off there? I know there was, I can't remember her name, she was a very famous American author. I believe she was African-American, and she had like all these kids and very busy life, and she was very poor, but she just decided every day I'm going to get up 1 hour earlier and just write for 1 hour a day. And I can't remember her name, but she was a very prominent, famous African-American author. And it's that kind of idea. You need to set aside the time for your creative pursuit. And it's not so much how much time you have, it's making the best use of that time.
Sure.
The other thing I'd say is, if it's possible, can she potentially work a little bit less? Is there a little bit more flexibility in terms of hours in her job? So for many years, I chose to work part-time as I continued to build my business. So I earned enough money to cover my responsibilities, but I definitely didn't live a lavish lifestyle because that was the cost I had to
sure.
I had to pay for that. But that's kind of the way I did it. So I think there's always room to follow your passion, and you just have to be flexible in terms of how you do that.
That's great.
That.
Yeah. I have one other suggestion for her as well in terms of, you know, sometimes people will get stuck in that. I hate my job. I loathe my job.
Yeah.
I despise what I do. But they're turning all the responsibilities away from themselves and seeing the job as somehow supposed to make them happy, as opposed to I need to make myself happy within my job.
That's smart.
And it's not everybody else's responsibility to give me that stimulation or make me feel interested. So sometimes people hate their jobs because they're bored. Well, boredom is overstaying your interest. So try to find something that's
else.
More interesting in your job.
Yeah.
See what's possible within the job of whether her boss or coworkers can change and exchange different kinds of responsibilities to make it a little bit more interesting. So I think all those together would be
that's a great
of good value.
Addition. Sure. I could see that for sure.
Yeah, I'd add to that as well. This is where mindfulness comes in as well, because mindfulness, if you are practicing mindfulness, you can make anything interesting. That is the point. If you learn how to, you can mindfully wash dishes. You can mindfully wait for a train. You can mindfully go for a walk. So when you put yourself more in those sort of calm mindfulness states, even things that once were boring tend to become more interesting because you've got a different perspective on the thing that you're doing.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes complete sense to me. Yeah.
If you just tuned in, you are listening to Dr. Deborah and Coach Kelly, and we are interviewing Alex George from Australia on his book, Maximum Mental Health, Overcome Depression, Anxiety, and Other Mental Illnesses with 20 Principles for Happier and Healthy Living. And he's got 3 mindfulness audio downloads that come along with the book, and that is just awesome. So, Alex, we have a few more minutes, and it would be interesting, too. We're kind of asking you questions. Is there something that you want to share more about you, about the book that we haven't or aren't directly asking?
Sure. I think the first thing to keep in mind, the book is kind of a dual focus. So one thing is it definitely does assist people who've got anxiety, depression, that sort of thing. But it is also a self-improvement manual. Like, I cover so many different topics. So I don't want people to kind of be scared with, oh, it says depression and I'm not depressed. You know, it's really a self-improvement manual, which also covers depression, anxiety. So it's kind of a 2-for-1 in that deal. And I said the other thing is that people will get the book within the next 24 hours. I'm going to give them some extra bonus materials, being some videos and extra training all around that. So that would be the first thing I'd say. And then the second thing is, it is Mental Health Month, and it is important to just be aware of the people around you, making sure they're okay. And I think that's part of what this book is about teaching people to feel good, to understand themselves, to understand others, and to be supportive of others. I talk a bit about social skills and social support in the book as well, because we are living in communities, and it is important for us as social creatures, that's what humans are, to connect with others as often as possible.
Beautiful. Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about principles of magnetism.
So magnetism, I'm referring to social influence, because we're all social creatures. And so magnetism, the chapters I talked about was relationships as in intimate, and relationships as in all types of social business relationships. So the way I like to start off is by saying that emotions are contagious. And whoever has the strongest emotion leads the interaction. Two people cannot be leading an interaction at one time. There's always one person is leading, there's always one person that's following at any point in time. And so what that means is the more positive you are, the more the other person is going to follow you in a good way. So basically, emotions are neutral, right? Mm-hmm. You've got two people, one person is mildly anxious, the other person is, you know, quite happy or quite confident, the anxious person is going to start to feel more happy, more confident. But the reverse is also true. If someone's, you know, moderately, severely anxious and the other person was only mildly happy, they're going to start to feel more anxious.
Sure. I could see that.
So the idea here is when you put yourself in the right emotional state and you go into these interactions, you know, from that place of happiness and confidence, and you have a goal in mind, you know, you're going to influence that person in a really positive way, that supersedes everything else, even status. You can influence and control your boss at work if you are just constantly positive and happy and focused, and they will start to follow you and your ideas and your suggestions. So that's that idea of magnetism.
Well, I really like that.
I do, but I was also thinking about, you know, that person at work that is always so happy and everybody's grumpy around them going, what is she so happy about? But yeah, no, that's really powerful, I think we underestimate how much people's moods and emotions influence us during the day. I mean, I can tell at the end of a day if I've worked with some of my patients who have had a lot of sexual trauma and physical trauma, and the impact of that on them, that at the end of the day, I feel so much heavier and so much darker. And it takes me much longer after those days to really just kind of lighten up
to get
and
out of it.
Let go of some of that and do more of that breathing and focusing on all the positive and wonderful things about life in the present.
Yeah. And I was going to ask, Alex, do you think that there are people who pick up other people's energy more? Because I always feel like I can pick up people's energy really easily.
That's a great question. I think yes and no. So I think a lot of communication is subconscious. So a lot of it's happening beyond the surface. What I think is more is you may be more receptive. You may kind of pick up on it quicker.
Uh-huh.
But I do think, you know, it's just whoever has the strongest emotions always leading. That's as far as I see. But it might also be you've got more of an attunement to certain emotions, and therefore you kind of lead to that a lot quicker. But as far as I'm concerned, that's what the research says. Basically, one person's leading, one person's following. Whoever's got the stronger emotion, whether it's positive or negative, doesn't really really matter. They're going to be leading that interaction.
And can you just reverse it very quickly? Let's say you walk into a room, the person has a really like intense, like negative attitude. It's so overpowering. Can you just kind of, you know, just come back with like, you know, a huge positive energy and kind of overtake it?
Yes, but you probably want to sort of startle them first. And when I say startle, I don't mean you could startle them through fear. You could just shake them or scare them, and that would totally work. Yeah, but you create a gap. So if you startle them, like you tell a joke, or you say, "What's that? What's that over there?" and they go, "What?" and then you hit them with the positive energy. Like, yeah, if you startle them first, it kind of breaks their state a little bit, and then you've got like a vacuum that you can then. It's more easy to implement where you're coming from through that sort of idea.
That's right, awesome. Cool. I'm going to get a handful of jokes and carry those around.
And use that.
Or a whistle.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, if you just say something really random or strange and they go, "Huh, what are you talking about?" And then you start smiling and then you start to lead them. So yeah, so the first thing to do is to kind of surprise someone. It's kind of like it's the startle response. And obviously in a more extreme circumstance, if you run into a room and you say, "Freeze," and the person just freezes, whatever you say next, they're going to do. I mean, that's what police do.
Sure.
So this is the more positive way of doing that. It's the same principle. You tell them a joke, or you say something weird, or you shake them, or you smile, or you say something completely bizarre, or something completely weird, and they go, "Huh, what are you talking about?" And then you start to lead them in
then
a more positive
infuse.
Place.
Oh, I love that. That's
that
great.
Is wonderful. So I'm really, really curious. This is a segue away from your book just for a moment. What does it take to become a psychologist in Australia? What's the educational process?
Yeah, so to be a clinical psychologist, which is what I am officially, it's a minimum of 6 years university training. So it's 3 years undergraduate, 1 year honours or honours equivalent, and then 2 years clinical masters. Then people can also do doctorates as well if they want to, but it's not necessary. So that's for clinical psychology. There are other forms of psychology that require at least 4 years of training, but for clinical it's at least 6, and it's always university based, so you've always got to have a university degree, at least 4 years to be a psychologist.
And is there some sort of licensing process also?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I have to be registered with the Australian Board of Psychologists and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, okay.
And are you treating patients currently, or are you just speaking and writing at this point?
No, I'm definitely treating patients currently. I'm always treating patients. I have been ever since I started, and I assume that will continue even if I end up moving, which I'm thinking of possibly moving to the UK or even spending some time in America. I'll still be treating in whatever way I can.
That's great.
Okay. Well, what a wonderful interview, Alex. Thank you so much for joining us. I want you to say anything else for last minute before we have to close off our show. Is there anything else that people should know about you in a nutshell?
Yeah, I'm going to tell people 5 quick strategies for depression, anxiety, becoming happy. Number 1, exercise. As I said, the more you move, the better you feel. Number 2, work on your mindfulness, work on your relaxation, do some calmness training. 3, practice gratitude. Just mention a few things every day that you're grateful for. Number 4, connect to and learn from positive people. And then number 5, find a creative pursuit. And really do everything you can, schedule whatever time you have, even if it's only a small amount of time, to follow that creative pursuit. Because I believe creativity is the essence of happiness. You are always happiest when you're doing something creative. So that's my 5 tips.
Beautiful. And if you missed those, then you can always catch them on the download for our show.
Yes.
If you want to replay the show. And don't forget to get a copy of Alex's book, Maximum Mental Health. Again, that's Maximum Mental Health. And it's Alex George, A-L-E-K. And your website again, Alex, is
MaximumMentalHealth.com. And if they go there within 24 hours of the show, I've got some extra bonuses for people who get the book.
That's wonderful. Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us, Alex. And hey, next week we're going to have another author who's going to be speaking with us. Her name is Jody Gould.
Yes.
And she's going to be talking about her book, High, not getting high as in using drugs, but high as in the 6 principles for guilt-free pleasure and escape. So we're looking forward to that as well. And Kelly, you and I didn't get much chatting in today, but
yeah, I know. But
I love you, girl.
You too. And Alex, thank you so
thank
much.
You.
You're wonderful.
Thank you very much, girls. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Okay.
All right,
good luck with
care.
The book.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.